Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. It's the 31st of December where I am. It might be in some places, it will be January 1st already. So, welcome to the 31st of December from Canada to our listeners in the Philippines and Brazil. And Greece and Russia and in the United Kingdom, Great Britain, in Brazil, South Africa. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And in North America and of course, here in Canada. So it's a pleasure, of course, my pleasure to feel that there's a link, a support. We're offering something useful. I always hope it's simply informative and educational. So we'll sit back in our comfortable chair. You will find a nice hot glass of tea or a cup of coffee or a dram or a pint or perhaps you're swirling a glass of wine. Yeah. Yeah, wherever you are in the face of the earth, it's a temporary indulgence here. Good program today. Interesting excursion into poetry. Something we haven't, I don't think in all the years, I've done any of the performed any of the poetry of J.R.R. Tolkien. And so there's a bit of a story about that I think is interesting. In researching, I came across a paper by an Afghanistan professor. And he has an interesting perspective that I'll share in little pieces. A lot of it is quite culturally intense, but it is nevertheless very, very interesting. Time for reflection. It's the time of the sea, everything in its time. And this is putting to rest 2023. And honestly, I wish, you know, once upon a time I could assume everybody understood what it meant. And as I get closer to it, and as my time resolves here on Earth, I have less sense of what I'm talking about at all. I can't tell you what time is. I just don't honestly know. I know, but I refer to it as passing. I can refer to anticipation, some emotional states, but I don't I don't have much sense of whether time is passing me or I'm moving through it. Does it matter amongst friends? No. Will the effect be the same whether we understand it or not? I tend to think it will. It's like a lot of the laws of the universe that swirl around us. I don't think when you or your colleagues make a discovery and communicate that to the rest, it brings meaning and shape to the universe that wasn't there before. And I'm drawn to that puzzle, that mind puzzle. If a tree in the forest falls when there's nobody around, is there a sound? Well, I tend to think no, there's no sound. The sound is when it's been picked up, when it's in the mind and it's able to be communicated, then it exists. Like so much of the craft and so many other things about our lives, I'm taken by some profound notions that seemed that I wanted to mock earlier in my life, things that I just determined were completely meaningless to me. And I find now there's been a great deal of effort over thousands of years to come to an understanding and to put it down, try and put it into words and ideas. And of course, those words and ideas will be picked up by others like me or you or somebody else. And we like any good scientist, we have to replicate the conclusions, don't we? We look carefully at methodology. We read through the idiosyncrasies of the work, the description of the thesis, and then we attempt to replicate it and then look and see if we get a similar or result as the paper suggests we will. Well, one day we bring a lot of excitement to this. One day we may have fusion and we may have perpetual motion. In the meantime, we have some interesting suggestions. So it's not that the world has made us cynical, but we need, like good scientists, we need proof. And then for that, we need to look carefully at and weigh the facts, what they tell us. And we need to be able to validate whether they are authentic facts, reliable. That determination, that decision always varies at the start. And it is rare that we find everybody in agreement around the world. When we do find agreement all around the world, we call that common sense. There's no debate. Well, no debate doesn't mean that we stop questioning and wondering and reasoning. Where does new information fit with our thinking? Masonry has always been intended to help make our world make life a little bit easier. Not simpler, but a little bit easier. When I think of all the people that I've met who've worked, when you think about it, people that work in emergency situations, well, the emergency of other people is day-to-day and routine for that select group of them. They are familiar and have protocols and ways, and they're able to simply able to anticipate, and they don't think of things as yucky or unpleasant. They are looking at the task at hand, and as you should. If you put me in the my good friend Kevin, a wonderful pilot that I met up in Yellowknife, lovely human being. And when I started to talk to you and get to be trusted by bush pilots, they are the most interesting people. Very confident. So, as I found, so confident, they had no need to prove it. No need for epaulettes and a briefcase to go to work. They were happy in a jumpsuit and a flight plan. Their skill with aircraft, their knowledge of flying was and is legendary for a reason. But what's interesting is talking to those men that had nothing to prove. It was just a delight, inquisitive, knowledgeable, but frank, just frank. There's no room for confusion, and these are fellows that were quite familiar with being decisive. And some of the things they told me about the proof of their capability, which I won't repeat on air because they may not be by the authorities, were truly the stuff of legends. So how to land on I didn't know what an escher was at the time, but then I found out about the nuance of coming in and landing on an escher and taking off for one. Who could do that? When I would be reading in the paper about some search and rescue, it was entirely likely one of the fellows in the room had been in the cockpit doing it. They're not thinking anything of it. This was for him. This was what he did. That he had the skills to do it. But my friend Kevin talked to me about, as a boy, liking big machinery, big machinery. And so for him, when he looked at the planes and all the complexity, for him, that was a big machine. You could understand. And flying with him was just quite remarkable. And going through some sort of reason to be panicky, and seeing that no, I was the only one that was concerned in the cockpit, put me at ease. These fellows are taught that they don't expect everything to be perfect and predictable. And so I came away with a different sense of a different experience. And it opened up my eyes to something that I had been ignoring up until then. But this type of thinking, this kind of person exists out there. And thank goodness. But they bring out something to those who, and I like to credit myself as being one of them, those who pay attention. And so maybe that's why we had struck up such wonderful friendships and had such great conversations well into the night. I like to think of them today, all of those fellows today. Last time I caught a great big northern pike was with those guys. Fantastic. Yeah. Float planes and fishing. Doesn't get any better. The sonic effects today, reflective, yeah. May old acquaintance be forgot, never brought to mind, makes me stop and think. I've been into this frame of mind for a while that not so sure anymore that I need to be remembered. I think I want to tell myself, of course, I'll be remembered forever. And the more I'm remembered, the better. But I don't know that. And when I think about the millions of people who have been you know, most of the people on the face of the planet have been born, the majority have been born since following my birth in 1949. And that's a bit odd to think that the people around me come and go, and so do I. The trees grow, and I come back to places that I haven't seen for now 40 or 50 years or longer, and they look different because there's trees grow. Trees 40 or 50 years old are big, big trees, and whole forests, and it's fascinating. I don't feel left out or that the world is going past me. I feel that it's just fascinating. Watch a measure of time. And then I turn, like you, to sources. I want to find out what all this means. And then even noticing I'm not the first, and noticing what effect would it have if I understood time. Then let's presume. Excuse me. Let's presume there are a few out there who have a sense of that, the fabric of the universe, and arrive at some comfort from their efforts. Does the learning is periodic, and Masonry helps to walk with us along that path, that perilous path in life. At some point, we begin to examine the questions, all the assumptions, all of them, I have to admit, all of them. Make a good man better? Oh, how do you unpack that? What is it that you're talking about? Is it the color of my skin? Is it my approach to faith or my understanding of science? Is it the way I treat people? Is it my sense of humanity and compassion? Is it my sense of charity for the most towards the most vulnerable? It's easy where I am in a capitalist country to find contrast. But I only say it's easy because it's familiar. This kind of thinking in any culture around the world is happening. What do we do with the most needy and toward them, and how much respect we show to them? It's like the, you know, notions of how we treat our most vulnerable, or in the culture that I am, a measure of our humanity is taken by how we treat our animals. But then we start to tip into the difference between policing and justice, between the law and justice. And for that, we have lessons to learn and perspectives to examine. But before we do that, oh my, it's, I like to stop and give us a sense of music to help bring us together. It's seasonal, and no, it's not starting with Auld Lang Syne. We'll get around to that, of course. Today I have to, but I'd like to, share just a little bit of time with you, and encourage imagination amongst us. Here, this is from Roddy Dowell's trio. Thank you. What was I thinking with this commentary? Living reality in a dream. It's the eve of the new year, 2024. It will not be denied. Life as we know it moves on in an expanding infinite universe with a beginning we cannot find and an ending we do not know. Of the ancient landmarks we promised to preserve, we are remarkably selective. We know within the fabric of our order there are scholars examining how principles are affected by the passage of time and cultural movement. Lodges take the education of Masons seriously. Learning is exposure to Masonic ideas and self-directed inquiry. What are we improving if we don't have a baseline? What is it we are attempting to improve? Outcomes. Reducing poor decisions, mistakes. It takes more than a minute to describe what a moral human is like. Does he do? What does he say? We admit we can shape thinking with the help of explanations because that is the raison d'etre of our brotherhood. But time hasn't slowed for us. We were never a machine. We were never an army. Masonry isn't ordered. It's chaotic. It's messy, like our thoughts, until we find framing. What feeds our growth is something we can't actually define, this thing called intelligence. Is it a way of thinking? Is it a memory? Is it wealth? Is it accumulation of power? Is that intelligence? Is it the ingenuity shown in action? Is it our display of or reverence for the arts? Despite decades of examination, the best we can explain is when it is absent. Masonry would work for most contemporary settings, if not for the word merit. Is that the meaning of intelligence? To understand our relationship with merit? If I smile and am friendly when you are obliged, then you are obliged to do the same, except that isn't equality in action to be presumptuous? Though our work is serious, it is not gloomy. We can be serious without being solemn or tedious. Do we need to treat our purpose with the respect it is due in other places? The tasks of a Mason are called challenges for a reason. It's the beauty of it all. It really is. Did you answer? That was, what are you doing for New Year's Eve? Here, stay with Masonic Effects. I want to share with you today ancient perspectives on the value of poetry. Yeah, poetry begins with conjecture. I never expect anyone to like the things that I like because I like them. I was introduced to them by people that thought that introductions were a good test to see if I might pick up an idea. That's all. It's like mothers who introduce new flavors, new tastes to their child at an early age so that they to try and expand the child's palate as they grow older. I'm not talking about the insouciance of a child that's only been fed one, tasteless kind of meal. For some children, that's all they have, and there is never a complaint. When children are hungry, there's a calm. There's no fighting. There's a calmness in the room, in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I've witnessed that. Maybe it's just helping the world to notice things a little differently. When I think about it, do you remember those, if you were around in the 50s, do you remember those long angular cars with big fins, aerodynamic, 2 tons, 3 tons of steel being aerodynamic? Comfortable, you could hit railroad tracks at full speed and hardly even notice it. It was just so springy and velvet. Mm. Front seats were like living room couches. Mm. The ashtrays had cigarette lighters. Yeah, those convenient little push-in lighters. Very, very convenient. And the more expensive cars had these convenient little ashtrays all over the place. More so than cup holders. Cup holders, or who would drink with coffee while you're driving? Of course not. Smoking, on the other hand, that was just considered essential. Essential. It's like you each have memories. I'll tell you a memory of a little boy. When I was a little boy with these rubber boots on, the kind that make little boys, they seem to swim on those skinny little legs, rushing along the lane as my grandfather was striding ahead, even before we brought the cows in from the field for morning milking, and going out to the bush to just look at the woods. Yeah, because you would harvest firewood out there for the stoves, and so he would chatter along to himself, and he wasn't a bit self-conscious about it. I learned later what was happening cognitively in humans when we do that. But he was the first, and he was going through working through problems and considerations and things he needed to do. It was like his notepad. And I would be struggling along behind, and sometimes he would look down, and most of the time, but the dew, the light, the air, all of it, when we're taught about the most powerful experiences, the smells are so, so powerful. They can bring back entire periods of events. And even emotion. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Now that to me is the beginnings of a poetic relationship with the world. Yeah. Now I found during these introductions, I was introduced to opera And I found, and by professors, people that understood far more about it than I could ever. And they did it in a way that was respectful of the ear of a student. Not overwhelming. It didn't start with Tosca, but started with operetta and an analysis. So we're going into these things, looking for the libretto, and you're looking for the meaning and the content, and you're looking for certain things the professor would suggest to us. And then the buzz when you came away and the class was, you know, just effervescent. It was overwhelmed by the experience. The professor had seen it before, of course, and wasn't smug about it. That was success. You know, he had passed that on. And then when my wife gave me season's tickets, oh, you know, then you think, well, one day the Met, one day La Scala, you know. But it never, when I'm sitting there listening to Terry Tikanawa, I'm not thinking about being somewhere else. Are you crazy? No, not at all. It was just that experience of so much music and the instrument. And to appreciate what, to hear it. It's like for me when I had my first radio that had tuning knobs and you could set tone. I thought that that was like sliced bread. That was just amazing, where I could actually enhance it to, and then in my car, having the car where I could change the tone of music and the speaker configuration so that it fit me sitting behind the wheel. And then at home, you're hearing, you know, the expensive stereo systems that just brought symphony alive. And now, it's portable. You know, I can bring an incredibly symphonic quality, almost symphonic quality sound out of these little tiny speakers. And do we enjoy that? Still, the opera? Of course, of course. So I don't expect anybody to. And I've taken enough, you know, kidding about it, that now I know I indulge myself when I'm alone, when I'm writing, or when I'm not going to be intruding on other people at all. I don't like to be intruding. But I suppose I could do more to encourage, but now I can walk around with different sound systems where I have all of the music as I can. It's probably pieces, of course, that aren't included, but I have it all the time around me. So I can select through my favorites, but I also like to have something played for me random, because that's the way I was brought up. In CBC every Thursday there would be organ recitals, and during my job at that time I would be in the car regularly when those pieces would be played, and then it was replayed in the evening. And lo and behold, who becomes familiar with the toccata in C? Well, you listen to it enough and you have, you know, somebody knowledgeable explaining what's going on, becomes more and more interesting and soothing. And even today, so I don't have the same taste I did when I was a little boy, let's say. Here, shall we talk about the ancient perspectives on the value of poetry? If we needed to know, this goes back, the value of poetry and the questions about it go back a great long time. Here, you'll immediately pick this up. Homer's Odyssey, the muse is specifically summoned and is generally considered to be Calliope, the muse of epic poetry by the tradition. Is this muse who speaks the same entity as the goddess who sings the rage of Peleus' son? Could this intangible force itself be a mimetic representation of a received tradition in spiritual form? And if so, Would this received tradition hail from the Mycenaean holdovers, 1100 to 600 BCE, still present in the late Dark Ages and early Archaic period? One way of answering this question is that it does not matter whether or not Homer was summoning a definite intangible influence from Mycenaean history using a typical rhetorical device, or in fact attempting to summon a goddess to sing through him. What matters, in a story at least, according to the ancient philosophers Aristotle and Plato, is the universal message contained within it. It will be seen that the poet's function is to describe not the thing that has happened, but a kind of thing that might happen, like what is possible as being probable or necessary. The distinction between historian and poet is not in the one writing prose and the other verse. You might put the work of Herodotus into verse, and it would still be a species of history. It consists really in this, for that the one describes the thing that has been and the other a kind of thing that might be. So poetry is something more philosophic and of graver import than history, since its statements are of the nature rather than of universals, whereas those of history are singulars. Aristotle argues that poetry is more philosophic and of graver importance than history in that poetry teaches universal rather than particular lessons. If this is the case, does it matter what and who influenced the poems of Homer? Based on Aristotle's view, how would one respond to an interlocutor who suggests that Homer's poems had a literal and religious value for his audience? The first response would be like this: just because a work of literature has religious value does not mean that it is taken literally. If the purpose of poetry is to convey a universal value, ostensibly, that value must be abstracted from the peculiarities of a singular narrative. This process itself is meta-literal. It involves digesting and articulating the message of a book rather than simply ingesting and regurgitating it, as Ion does in Plato's work of the same name. The response is this: if a work is considered of religious importance to a people, say 5th century Athenians, does that mean that the work is beyond interpretation, or that the work, in contrast, requires interpretation? Plato also has something to say about the nature of imitation. The character Socrates argues in Book 10 of Republic that the limitations of a poet's knowledge and skill may in fact require interpretation rather than simple comprehension, whether the poem be religious or not. So when we hear Pearson saying that the tragedians and Homer, who is at their head, know all the arts and all things human, virtue as well as vice and divine things too, for that the good poet cannot compose well unless he knows his subject, then that he who has not this knowledge can never be a poet, we ought to consider whether here also there may not be an illusion. Perhaps they may have come across imitators and been deceived by them. They may not have remembered when they saw their works that these were but imitations, thrice removed from the truth. Plato, Aristotle's teacher of 20 years, complicates the question of what the value of poetry is. Aristotle clearly writes that poetry derives its value from articulating universal truth, unlike history. Plato considers the possibility that poets, like Homer, might have known all things human and divine things too, and that one who does not know such things might not become a poet. So Plato also suggests the possibility that the poets could just be imitators, and not only imitators, but imitators of imitators, who may not have remembered when they saw their works that these were but imitations thrice removed from truth. And such poets would then write stories full of falsities, not based on knowledge of the subject, but based on imagining the subject. If one could then desire to take a Platonic, Aristotelian view of the value of reading Homer, one would attempt to discover which truths in his Iliad are universal, rather than attempt to decipher the range of his cultural influences. History is mysterious and amazing facts, but poetry empowers it. Today, I'm going to share with you something that, you know, it's been on the shelf for a long, long time. This is seems fitting too, at least in my mood, the mood I've been in lately. This is the work of J.R.R. Tolkien, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. He was born in South Africa on January 3rd, 1892, and he died on September 2nd, 1973 in Bournemouth, England. He was 81 years old. Now, the guy had spent most of his life at Oxford teaching English language and literature. He specialized in Old and Middle English at the universities of Leeds in the 20s, and then from then on, Oxford. And he had kept good company. He produced some influential publications, a standard edition of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and a landmark lecture on Beowulf in 1936. And he completed a translation of Beowulf in 1926, and it was posthumously published along with classroom lectures he had given on the subject. Interesting guy. Interesting man. He amused himself by writing an elaborate series of fantasy tales, which we know has made him quite famous, often dark and sorrowful and set in a world of his own creation. He made this legendarium, which eventually became the Silmarillion, partly to provide a setting in which elvish languages he had invented could exist. But his tales of Arda and Middle-earth also grew from a desire to tell stories. So I'm not going to get into that part. This is about the walking nature. And we know that he was friends with C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis was a walker. And Lewis was what I would call an aggressive walker. He strode on, and it was a workout, and that's what they did at the time. And this was, as we know, a big part of life in Britain, wasn't it? To do the walks and to have access, not unlike us, where our government has made it policy that you don't have access to most of the land anymore. That it's been privatized in Britain. They've made these sort of, we find them eccentric kind of rules where you have access. You can walk through the trails, just continue to walk the nation. I love that kind of a sensitivity and connection with the land. I really, truly do. This is a poem written as a walking song, and that's what it's called. And in the Lord of the Rings, you'll hear them sing this. You'll hear them sing different songs, supper songs, and but this is one that they will sing to make the trip seem to go a little faster, a little easier. You know, if you've ever been on a work crew where you sing something or you chant something, it's interesting, and it does sort of elevate the work. It keeps you all at a pace. Upon the hearth, the fire is red. Beneath the roof, there is a bed. But not yet weary are our feet. Still round the corner, we may meet. A sudden tree or standing stone that none have seen but we alone. Tree and flower and leaf and grass, let them pass, let them pass. Hill and water under sky, pass them by, pass them by. Still, around the corner, there may wait a new road or a secret gate, and through we pass them by today. Tomorrow we may come this way and take the hidden paths that run toward the moon or to the sun. apple, thorn, or nut and sloe, let them go, let them go. Sand and stone and pool and delve, fare you well, fare you well. Home is behind, the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread. Through shadows to the edge of night, until the stars are all alight. Then world behind and home ahead, we'll wander back to home and bed. Then twilight, cloud and shade, always shall fade, always shall fade. Fire and lamp and meat and bread, and then to bed, and then to bed. Amazing. I'm just going to put together a little bit of something that will capture the moment here. Yeah? Beautiful, beautiful. It's we're going to just visit for a second. Yeah. We're going to visit Holland in the 18th century. It's just the examination. It really is allowing us, with the passage of time, to hold our attention at arm's length to events that today would probably be triggering all manner of silliness, you know, that tediousness. But I talk to you as brethren, not typical, not typical of the craft. I thought if there was a group of students in a university who had read a little bit about the craft and were interested in starting their own lodge, they would be met with this, let's say they were academics, and you know that the dilettante academic, you're very much in earnest, and you're in the pub after hours and hours, you're getting used to the strain, everything is in the mind, you're reading it, consuming tremendous amounts of information, and you have the backstop of this earnestness. You know, campuses are just, it's earnest, there's energy, things are happening. And then to be met with enthusiasts, you know, it's like cheerleaders coming out. I always find it that way. We send out our cheerleaders and their giggles and well-founded, but the gravitas is not there. I know. I would think that it would be at the very least slightly concerning for the group of more serious thinkers to be met with that kind of experience. It's how would they ever discover the pleasure of a more qualified conversation with the likes of you? I don't know. By the roll of the dice, I guess, by some connection with some person. Yeah, I'm not sure myself how they would ever discover it, except it happens. I don't find that this question even is pertinent in old cultures. I'm not an apologist for this. I'm in a new culture, it's still emerging, and we have the pressures, the contemporary pressures that every country around the world does. We breathe the same air, we drink the same water, but our pin on the map is at a different place. We're going to be reminded of this in this small piece of history that we're getting into on this last day of 2023. My goodness. Strasbourg. Strasbourg housed a respectable university, and the German poet Goethe graduated from it in 1771. So let's give it a bit of credibility because of that. Yeah, really. The university even sported a lodge of aristocratic students, but many locally renowned intellectuals were notably absent from the lodges. In short, by mid-century, enclaves of the newly enlightened culture did reside within Strasbourg's walls, nurtured in part by its publishing industry and its geography. The new scientific society of the 1760s contained men who would later appear in Masonic rank, not least the young Goethe. Yet amid Enlightenment, there remained a palpable tension between Strasbourg's Catholic and Protestant populations, a tension that only certain forms of sociability managed to transcend. Among them were the lodges, although interestingly enough, the founders of Strasbourg Freemasonry were Catholic, as was the vast majority of the brothers. The first lodge, created by a Protestant, was founded in 1779. Both the culture of the old order, with its divisions by confession and kinship, and the new culture of enlightenment, with its emphasis on worldly ethics and the transcendence of rank and estate, were vividly present in Strasbourg Freemasonry. This is the nature of any mature civil society. It creates a zone of social interaction where people meet somewhat formally as individuals. They reflect existing power relations and conflicting value systems just as they attempt to mediate them. The dangerous part arises when civil society offers a more accurate reflection of power and greater opportunity to address them than does the established political order. Something to think about. The tensions within the Strasbourg lodges may be particularly related to the controversial history of the order within its provincial setting. In the 1740s and later, the hostile Catholic clergy of Strasbourg refused absolution to Freemasons in the town, and at the same time, the brothers were accused of homosexuality. Possibly with memory of these events, in 1763, a lodge was established for women, and a woman was chosen as the patron for the essentially aristocratic La Candeur. The La Candeur, probably one of the most conservative lodges to be found in France, we find strongly Christian tendencies with various Catholic reformers in the 1780s. Among them, Cagliostro, a mystical Freemason and a Catholic. He and Cardinal Rohan held seances in the lodges to search for regeneration. Protestant Freemasons, Strasbourg had a large Protestant population, were predictably suspicious of these activities, regarding them as the old Counter-Reformation in new garb. By contrast, lodges in other provincial centers surrounded by rich agricultural land, in Burgundy, for instance, had privileged memberships, which nevertheless mixed nobles with lawyers and some important wine growers and merchants. So what's changed? The public image of the craft is more class reference than it ever has, I find, as I look through my selective reading of history. It's as if we've been marketing to the greater mass, and we know that if you're, and this is an interesting decision that seems to have been made a long time ago hereabouts, although I know that, you know, a university education, well-educated people, very successful people, are a small niche group in a larger population. Where I am, the focus has been on that large base, that broader base, not the people of means, the people of that would have acquired a liberal education. I'm not talking specifics and doing headcounts, but I'm talking about values. And that's a different kind of a conversation to hold, but not one we're going to hold today. I'm not exactly reluctant about this, that the year is coming to an end. No. 2024, it has a nice ring to it. and so will 2025. I'm aiming, and I'll try and influence all of you, if I can, if I have any credibility at all, to prepare the lodge and for the generation 50 years down the road. How do we do that? What will be important to them? And I think we have the plan open for us. This is a goodbye for the season to one and all. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. My goodness, the world media and all our smartphone technology wants us to believe we're all just a chaotic a bunch of louts making up our own facts as we go along, and that's simply not accurate. The majority of people in the world are trusting, lovely people that want the same thing you and I do. They need stability, some safety. They want to be able to provide for their family, and when they get together, to be able to relax and enjoy themselves. It's not asking a lot. We have to do something a little different. So if you're thinking the status quo is never changing, wrong. It's changing very quickly. So you and I have influence. We're influenced. We open ourselves to influence. And in exchange, we have an expectation that we share that influence, whatever our findings are. In the meantime, be well. And I hope the very best for all of you. Thanks very much for tuning in. We'll see you in 2024. And this is from my childhood here in Canada. Guy Lombardo. My goodness. Canadian orchestra, eh? Bye. Bye. Oh, and did you brethren in Russia think that I had forgotten you? Not a bit. See you next year.